So a power of attorney is a legal document designed to give the person granting the power, and that could be any one of us, to someone they designate as their agent to make different kinds of decisions for them in the future or even at the present. Now, last week's episode probably mostly concerned healthcare power of attorneys, but we could make them, and people often do, for financial purposes as well.
So in the healthcare setting, what does a power of attorney allow us?
Well, this differs from state to state, but as a general overview, and I think this is true in Missouri, the power of attorney document exists so that essentially, just as you might imagine, you name yourself, you acknowledge that you're about to designate some authority, you name the person you identify, and then you delineate what the sort of parameters of the authority are, right? You could give all decision-making authority away, or you could give just healthcare decision-making authority away. And then you have to sort of indicate whether or not it takes effect immediately, which means upon signature, or whether it's supposed to take effect either at some date in the future or more likely because of some triggering event in the future, like your incapacity to make your decisions. And that typically requires verification by a healthcare provider. It's not a subjective sort of determination that somebody can't make their decisions anymore.
And so whose responsibility is it to review that document to make sure that's in place? Is it the health provider? Is it the patient? Is it the person who's designated power of attorney? Where does this all rest?
Well, it's interesting. When you complete a power of attorney for any purpose, you're always told, okay, now it's in your custody and it's your job to disseminate it to the universe of people that you think need to know about it. So obviously, if it's for healthcare, you're supposed to, as the person designated someone, take the obligation of distributing that document to your healthcare providers. And that's why you're asked for it when you go to an emergency department. Now, it may have been a crisis, so you don't remember this, but they will say, do you have, you know, any sort of advanced health care directive? Because there are other kinds, all right, more in the category of living wills and so forth. But they'll ask you about it. And sometimes you can say, oh, it's already attached to my file, or my primary care physician has it, or I have a copy here in my purse, all right? Or as my favorite commentator once said, or it's tattooed to my clavicle. Okay, but, you know, however you want to transport it around, whether you want a part of your body or a piece of paper, the responsibility is on you. And also, similarly, if you change it, the responsibility is upon you to sort of retract the old ones and distribute the new ones. Suppose you changed your opinion about who your agent should be, so you had a superseding document. Now, in reality, people complete them, they distribute them, and sometimes they kind of forget them. Only when they're reminded by a sort of medical crisis. So it's not as if it's a document people typically have in their like hip pocket on a daily basis.
Should people have that in their hip pocket?
Well, one circumstance where that would seem to be particularly pressing is when you're a non-family member, so non-blood relation, who's been designated as the agent, and it may be that you are involved in a kind of relationship that the blood family members don't either necessarily approve of.
Well, here's a question.
Hospitals are confusing places around these issues. Hospitals are often confused about who is the agent.
So what happens if you're not a blood relative?
Well, you know, so the federal government, beginning in 2011, decided that it would, because of a lot of public feedback, try and clarify the situation where there are essentially non-blood relatives and non-legally recognized relationships. Okay, and in the state of Missouri, a same-sex couple that may hold themselves out as husband and husband and may hold themselves out as a civil union, in fact, those are statuses that don't exist.
Under legal terms, that doesn't exist.
It doesn't mean anything in Missouri. So those are social terms. So I think that the federal government, hearing complaints, stepped forward, the president first, requiring Health and Human Services to clarify to hospitals that they would respect the wishes of patients, first and foremost. Second of all, that they would abide by the terms of legitimate and valid powers of attorneys. And then finally, that they would acknowledge that a legitimate and valid power of attorney could be someone who is not in a blood relationship with you. Even outside of same-sex relationships, we're going to have people using non-family members for their powers of attorney. That's probably a good thing, because what's the default? If you don't have a power of attorney, then the hospital staff and the ethics committee have to sit around. They never knew you. They don't know anything about you, you know, your aspirations for your life and your death, and figure out, oh, what you want. Now, is that really? I mean, that's a kind of, I mean, these are good and decent people, but that is a kind of a cold calculus.
Anne Marie Marciarelli, professor of law at University of Missouri, Kansas City. Thanks for speaking with me.
Oh, you're welcome.